I'm Associate Professor of European and International Politics at the European Institute here at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And I'm very pleased to be welcoming Professor Michel Cini to LSE today and to be joined by my LSE colleague Marina Cino Pagliarello to launch her book, Ideas and European Education Policy. We have it here. Why don't you hold it up? Constructing the Europe of Knowledge, published by Palgrave. So congratulations. I'm also very pleased to welcome both our online audiences and our audience here in to the event. So the book, Ideas and European Education Policy, which I had the honor of having a little bit supervision of it, as a, when it was still a PhD thesis. It's a unique, theoretically informed and empirically rich study that analyzes the transformations of European education policy from 1973 until 2020. The book constructs a novel three-stage analytical framework which captures how ideas open new political spaces and how problem entrepreneurs define policy issues. It chronicles the transformation of European education from a national to a supranational concern, highlighting the process and mechanisms through which the European Commission and the European business community constructed the idea of the Europe of knowledge as a solution for Europe's lack of competitiveness. So for the event, I would like to ask you to put your phones down. Actually, this works like this on my phone. No, this is on silent. So as not to disrupt the event, it's being recorded and will hopefully be turned also into a podcast on this subject. If there are no technical difficulties, of course. As usual, there will be the chance for you to put your questions to our panelists. So for our online guests, this means that you can submit your questions via the Zoom Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. And please include, if you do, your name and affiliation. And for those of you here in the audience, in the theater, I will let you know when we will open the floor for questions. So then please raise your hand, wait for the our stewards with a roving microphone to get to you, and please also let us know your name and affiliation. So I will try to ensure a range of questions from both our online audience and our audience here in the theater. But now, without further ado, I will introduce the panel in a little bit more detail. We have, of course, the person of today, Marina, I still have to introduce you. Marina Cino Pagliarello is a visiting fellow at the LSE's European Institute, a lecturer in political economy, was a lecturer of political economy at the Department of Government at Essex University, and an associate lecturer at the UCL Department of Political Science. And prior to joining academia, Marina worked as education policy researcher and specialist with national and international organizations and governments for over 20 years. Previous qualifications include a PhD in European Studies from the London School of Economics and an MSc in Economics and Arts and Culture from the Pony School of Management and an MA in History from the University of Pisa. Since 2012, Marina has worked as a research associate for LSE Consulting, where she's co-led several projects on education for a wide range of clients. Michel Cini, to her right, is professor of European politics at the University of Bristol. She's worked at the University of Bristol for over
many years.
I'll still say over 25 years. She was initially appointed in 1991 as a Jean Monnet lecturer in European Community Studies. Her research is primarily on the politics of and policy making of the European Union, focusing on areas including the politics of the European Commission, EU state aid policy, and public ethics and lobbying. And so we'll now have a presentation by Marina for about 15 minutes. We'll have a discussion by Michelle for about 10 minutes. We'll have a panel discussion for approximately 20, 25 minutes, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Marijke. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And it's really a pleasure for me to present my book in the very same place where this book was somehow conceived, because exactly I did my PhD at the European Institute. And thank you so much to Carolina and Polly for having organized it, and to Marijke and Michelle for being here. And with both of them, I also have a special bond, because Marijke was my supervisor and Michelle was my external examiner. So it feels like, you know, I am
returning a bit back in the years.
So in the next 15 minutes, I will present very shortly what this book is about. So a bit on the structure, some key highlights regarding the theoretical and empirical findings. And then I will conclude with some key takeaways before starting the conversation with you. So first of all, let me start with the motivation. Why this book? What really brought me to examine and go back with 40 years of history and understanding European education policy? What you see now, what you see here, is what is now European education policy. Maybe some of you are not experts of European studies, but as you might know, or not, education is not a common policy. Education is still a very strong and domestic policy field at European Union level. However, despite that, as you can notice, something is going on. There is what we know called the open method of coordination. There are policy instruments, there are common objectives, there are common frameworks. There is the European Commission monitoring every year the progress that member states do in terms of education policies. Here you can see the objectives. And then we have a quote from this guy, Xavier Prat-Monet, who was former general director of DG Education and Culture, who says, we cannot tell member states what to do, because exactly education is a member state competence, but we can tell them how they are doing and what they should do to improve their education system. So from this puzzle, okay, why, without being a common European policy, the Commission is having a say in these policy fields. So from this puzzle started my motivation for the PhD. And in short, exactly, this book tries to explain the transformations that occurred in the policy from the mid-70s, when we had the first General Directorate for Education. Actually, we had a DLSC, and Ralph Dahrendorf was the first Commissioner for Education in 73, until 2020, because the book, of course, finishes now. What type of transformations? Two sets of transformations. The first one, which we saw a bit already in the previous slide, is that education, being from this gray area, very sensitive domestic policy field, has become now a sort of European education area, which has been formalized by the European Commission. But in parallel to these institutional changes and the increase of responsibility of the Commission, there is also another change, more, let's say, content related. So this sort of shift from how education was in the mid-70s, so very close to social dimension, equality of opportunities, rights of women, citizenship, democracy, culture, into a sort of policy very much focused on economic competitiveness, growth, and employability. So these are the two sets of transformations that this book tries to understand and explore. And the book and myself was particularly interested not so much in the outcome of this agenda, so what's happening in member states, but I was very much interested in this process of change. So how from 1973 we arrived in 2020 with this configuration. And the book basically traces, it's a story of a transformational change, how this change came about, including also the firm establishment and institutionalization of the European Union in a policy field, whereas there is no really mandate. The same mandate is the one of the Treaty of Maastricht, so supporting and supplementing member states. But as we have seen, there is much more. And in doing this sort of historical reconstruction of the policy, what I found was that a specific problem definition of education, so education defined as a solution to remedy against Europe lack of competitiveness, basically reconstructed a sort of political landscape and empowered new actors to have a say in the policy. In particular, the book is focused on the role of the European Commission and to some extent on the role of European business, which is very much unknown at the moment. So I hope to have advanced a bit also our understanding of what does business have to do in education. And this education agenda was constructed, and that's the title of the book, around this knowledge, around this notion of the Europe of knowledge or the knowledge economy. These are two very different things, but I use both terms in a simultaneous way because this is how they are used in European documents on education. So knowledge economy or Europe of knowledge. And going beyond education, what the book does basically tries to track down the contribution that ideas do in policy making. So in short, this is basically what this book is about. How it's structured, basically what I did, I applied an analytical approach to this temporal development of the events, and I constructed, of course, not out of the blue, but with a theoretical synthesis of different literature, a three-stage causal model. And basically, this model tries to understand how ideas emerge and how they open new political spaces. And this model is characterized by three stages, which are: the first one is how a problem definition emerges in the political arena. And in the book, corresponds to the period mid-70s, mid-80s. Then there is the development of this problem definition in the political landscape. So how a problem definition, how defining, for example, in my case, education, a problem of competitiveness rather than a problem of citizenship, can empower specific actors over others, but also how defining education as a supranational problem rather than a national one can also shift venues in which the policy is set. And then the third stage, which is the institutionalization of this problem definition as policy solution. And as you can see, this is also developed empirically from 1997 to 2010. How did I do this, which I think was the most challenging thing, you know, when studying ideas? How do you study the role of ideas? Basically, I did three things. First, I went, like an historian, I went to the historical archives of the European Commission in Florence, but also I analyzed a lot of private and confidential sources. I also adopted precisely this long-term horizon to understand when the idea firstly emerged and how this idea developed over a long-term time frame. And then I tried to understand who were these ideas carriers, so the actors that basically carried this idea. And then this is the table of content of the books. As you notice, basically the three main stages, so the emergence, the development, and the institutionalization are developed in their empirical chapters. There is a final chapter, which I'll tell more later about this, on this resilience, so how is the policy now, but this is more an exploratory chapter. And this is basically the illustration of my theoretical framework. I'm more than happy to discuss later, but just as a To give you an idea, the three stages, so the emergence, development, and institutionalization, we do have a pre-existing situation, and then we have, for example, stage one, which is when a problem definition emerges. So when a problem emerges in the political arena. And according to the framework that I designed, we need to have two things. First, we need to have a change in the material condition. Can be a shock, can be a technological progress, can be any kind of focal event. But then, in order for a problem to emerge, to enter in the political arena, we also need a political entrepreneur that acts as agent of change. Then, once we have a new problem definition, the problem definition, what does? Develops and sets specific boundaries. So again, if education is competitiveness, perhaps business is much more empowered rather than trade unions, for example. The same at the example of the venue I was telling earlier. So basically, in this stage of the development, we have these policy entrepreneurs who, through a mechanism of social construction, so here I take a lot into consideration rhetorical strategies, naming, blaming, shaming, accounting, storytelling, through all these narratives, basically policy entrepreneurs who resonate, of course, with the problem definition, can advocate their own solution to the problem. And then we have the final stage, which is the institutionalization. So when the problem definition becomes institutionalized, so in my case was the open method of coordination, in which, as you can notice, there are more constraints because this is the stage in which the policy is chosen. So it answers more to sort of rationalist explanations because the solution is to be economic viable, administrative viable, and politically viable. And as you notice, basically, on the left, then there is this alignment of the different stages with the zeitgeist. The zeitgeist is how we call it, this certain set of assumptions, the ideological assumptions that are prevailing at a specific moment in time. So in the case of the book, we'll make examples later. For instance, the zeitgeist of the mid-80s was much more, you know, Europhile, or vision of, you know, European integration, whereas the zeitgeist of the 90s was, in this case, you know, much more, you know, neoliberal compared to the other one. And this also matters because the alignment of the problem definition with the specific climate of the time can increase or decrease the likelihood of the problem definition to move in the political arena. So what are the highlights? As I was saying before, I distinguish between the empirical, you know, facts, which are very interesting for those who are much more interested in education, and then a bit more theoretical. So first of all, one of the key findings of the book is that this concept of the Europe of knowledge, you know, we all know with the Lisbon Strategy in 2000, this big mantra of the European Union becoming the most dynamic and knowledge-based competitive economy in the world, blah, blah, blah. Well, all these did not appear out of the blue in 2000, but rather it was the result of an incremental, lengthy and complex process that started in the mid-80s. So that's, you know, the first thing. In particular, it is in 1973-85, so that's, you know, the chapter on the emergence of this problem definition, that we have this shift from a social to a more economic conception of education. That's the period of the first mobility programs, Erasmus, Comet, and it's the period in which this happened. You remember before I said, you know, for a problem definition to enter, you need a problem entrepreneur. And all this happened under the additional leadership of Peter Sutherland, that, again, we all know Peter Sutherland, he was commissioner for competition, but not so many people know that Sutherland was commissioner for education for 8 months in 1985. And in these 8 months, he basically did a sort of mini revolution because he managed to achieve what previously could not have been achieved. In this case, was the mobility programs. Then we have the development of this problem definition. So this discourse of crisis of the European Union, lagging behind US and Asia, and that was, you know, this discourse of crisis pushed forward by the European Commission, saying either we collapse or we die, or we invest in education as US and Japan do, so we can again be Europe and we can again be great again. So that was the period in which basically the Commission with the European business somehow managed to advance, to advocate this discourse of crisis, asking, you know, the fact that education policies in member states needed to be a bit more coordinated. And here, one very important actor was European business, in particular two actors. One was the IRDAC, which does not exist anymore, was this committee of industrialists of Europe. The second one, which still exists, is the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which I don't know if you're aware of them, but they are the 50, now 50 at the time, they were 12, CEOs of the most important multinational in Europe. Well, it was precisely the European business that in 1997, 1996 started to publish a lot of policy reports and saying that Europe needed a sort of benchmarking for education policies. It needed a sort of open method of coordination, and I quote literally from their documents, for education policy, and the Commission should have been entrusted of this task. So basically, it seems that the European business had a very big role in what is the actual shape of the European Union education policy in terms of benchmarking and monitoring and so on. This was, again, you remember the zeitgeist we said before, you know, in 1985, it was much more, you know, pro-integration, Europhile, and Jacques Delors. Here we are, you know, the 1992 project, so the assumptions of neo-capital, of human capital approach and so on, so education is embedded within this discourse. Oops, of course I made a mistake. Okay. And then we have the institutionalization of this problem definition, in which it's very clear that since the 2000 ongoing, that education is now strongly linked and embedded with European economic policies. Indeed, education is also part of the annual growth and stability pact. So these are basically the key findings from an empirical point of view. Then, as I was saying, I added this chapter 2010 and 2020 called Between Resilience and Change, because now we are in another zeitgeist, right? So we are in this sort of polycrisis. We have Brexit, migration, COVID, Ukraine. So now education is also in a moment of, you know, rethinking where we want to go with our education policies. In terms of theoretical contribution, basically what I try to do in this book is to challenge this sort of conceptualization of ideas as a monolithic block of meanings. So ideas given, taken for granted, and as scholars we do study the effect of ideas. So what I'm trying to do is to study the process and also try to study this dynamic nature of ideas and not static. And in particular, one of the key highlights of the book is that rather than defining what are ideas, because we can find 20,000 definitions in the literature, maybe it's better to focus on the function of ideas in policy making. What function do they have? So in this case, ideas can serve as problem definition. So in the case of education, is a problem of competitiveness or low competitiveness. Ideas can serve as policy solutions. So in the case of the open method of coordination, it's the classic Peter Hall, you know, policy solution instrument. And then ideas can work as zeitgeist. So these ideological assumptions at a given moment in time, which, as I showed you in the empirical highlight, for each part of these, you know, developments of education policy, there was a specific zeitgeist going on, which I think it's part and parcel of the analysis. And another thing that I'm trying to do is that, you know, when we talk about ideas, the key argument is that ideas are powerful because they are pushed forward by powerful actors. However, if we say this, I think that, you know, we risk to miss a lot of what is the role of ideas in policy making. In my case, for example, the idea of the Europe of knowledge is this idea which is polysemantic, so one idea that has different meaning, because if you think about the Europe of knowledge, it is a knowledge economy, is knowledge society, is research, is innovation. It's even intended with the humanistic values. If you remember in 1998, when there was the ministers, you know, criticized a lot the Sorbonne Declaration, they said Europe should not be only the Europe of Euro, but should be the Europe of knowledge. So knowledge in that case was much more humanistic. So, and why policy is important to study and investigate? I think it's important because it's really this ability that ideas have to aggregate different actors with different interests, but given that the idea is so polysemantic, so each of them can find, you know, their own interest in the idea. So this is basically the key argument on this, you know, flexibility of ideas. And also another highlight is this role of the problem entrepreneur in triggering policy change, because we always focus a lot on policy entrepreneurs who have solutions ready for policy problems. However, what about the problems? Now, who faces the problem? Who decides what is the problem? And then another important highlight is this importance, as I was saying, of discussing rhetorical strategies, because I think that in political science, sometimes we forget how important they are. And we have seen, you know, with Brexit, with Trump, how important is the use of rhetorical strategies in politics and how convincing it can be. So basically, in terms of key takeaways, the first key takeaway of this book is on the role of ideas. So let's move on from studying the effect of ideas in policy making, but let's start to understand the process of these ideas. So it's a more sort of causes of effect approach. So why ideas emerge? Who is pushing one idea? Why one idea wins over another one? What are the implications? Then the second key takeaway is that ideas can create, again, entry or exit options by legitimizing or not specific topics. So again, education is competitiveness, so is a social inclusion, or both. Venues, so national, supranational, and so on, and then actors and institutions, as I was mentioning before. In my case, or according, you know, to what I found, the commission and the business emerge as the winner of this, you know, Europe of knowledge, whereas trade unions emerge as those who have been a bit marginalized. Then another important thing is that ideas are more likely to influence policy choices when they can frame a problem, okay, in a new way, and when this framing suggests basically a solution that can appeal to a different range of actors, as it was the open method of coordination. And for example, now I was saying in the beginning, education was a gray area in the 70s. It was a taboo topic. No one could talk about education. Then now education, we talk at European level about education. Well, this is also the fact that education was framed by Peter Sutherland in a way which was much more appealing, because education was framed as a problem of European competitiveness. It was not an interference of the Commission in member states. That would have been exactly would have had the opposite effect. And then, as I was saying before, problem definition matters. In the mid-80s, for example, we had this big problem of unemployment shock and technological change. According to the document, on the beginning, this problem, okay, education related to this problem, was interpreted as a social adjustment. So you could even read the word. So we need to socially adjust, we need to protect women that lost the job, we need to do this and that. Then, in the space of less than 1 year, education was not anymore a social adjustment, was economic adjustment to this, to the same problem. So basically, It is absolutely conceivable that to the same problem pressure we find a different solution according to what we decide to emphasize and privilege. And to conclude, the way forward and some food for thought maybe to open the discussion as well. So that's my last chapter, the last chapter of the book is, are we going towards this new problem definition of education? Are we changing a bit? Because now what we can see is that on the one hand, the Commission has surely increased this sort of soft power in education. The European education area is a formalized and institutionalized configuration at European level. But at the same time, no, there is, I think, I don't know, maybe I would also love to hear your opinion from the EU level, there is also an increasing discourse in parallel, talking about culture, values, identity, and so on. For instance, Horizon 2020 program, for the first time after many years now, they have a full call on culture, education, and democratic education. This is something that, you know, 5 years ago, I think would have been pretty weird to find. Now we have. So this suggests that perhaps education with this, you know, sort of unilateral connotation of employability is changing a bit. Also because, you know, we are all changing a bit, right, in terms of complex times. Education is also, you know, this case of a policy change, right, in a European public policy, which is characterized by ambiguity and issue and institutional complexity. If I ask now each of you, what do you think is the purpose of education, I'm sure you will all give me different answers, right, because education is a complex policy field in which you have different ideas, employability, inclusion, democracy, and so on. And then, finally, perhaps, you know, the ambition would be that this free stage model is applied to similar cases and ideas. For instance, I find absolutely fascinating the idea of active aging in health policy, how they are changing this, because it's not so much no running and eating healthy, but is, okay, if you get sick, it's your fault because you did not aged actively. So there is also a policy connotation in this active aging. The same for sustainability, or the same now resilience, right, with COVID, which is, you know, even at European level on the resilience recovery plan and so on. So I think I shall stop here. And thank you so much for having this.
I think Marina's covered everything that I was going to say, so you'll probably hear a little bit of repetition in this presentation. But first of all, I'd like to thank Marijke and Marina also for her presentation, which I enjoyed enormously. And I'm very happy to comment on Marina's excellent book. I'm going to use my time quite simply to say a few words and raise a few points. But also to ask a number of questions that we can pick up, hopefully, at least some of them, maybe in the panel discussion afterwards. So Marina's already summarised the content of her book, but I think it's worth restating the key elements of her project in my own words. So I see the book as seeking to account for the transformation of European education policy, taking a long-term perspective. It explains the reorientation of education policy towards a supply-side approach, privileging economic growth, employment, and competitiveness over other priorities, culminating in the Lisbon Strategy of 2000 and charting its development since then. At the same time, the book also investigates what might be termed the Europeanization of education policy over this same period, this process taking the form of an enhanced role in the policy for the European Commission in particular, although Marina, of course, also mentions the role of business as well. And this is based, the Commission's role is based on primarily on the open method of coordination. So it's a coordinative role that the Commission plays. The key theoretical contribution, it seems to me, rests with the role played by ideas in this transformation. Of course, Marina has already spoken at length about the role of ideas. We'll come back to that, I'm sure, again. The role of ideas is dissected using this three-step framework that Marina explained, and that also serves as a chronology or periodization in the book. So it structures the kind of narrative of the book, but also reflects the causal relations between different variables that Marina identifies as being important. So first we have the emergence of the problem definition, then the development of that problem definition, and subsequently the institutionalization of the problem solution at the end of the process. So the research uses a process tracing methodology, which we can perhaps ask some questions about later on, how that works in practice, drawing on interviews and rich documentary and archival analysis. So in essence, as appeared on Marina's final slide, I would say this book is about policy change, both theoretically and empirically. Policy change is a concept that's frequently researched, but which poses challenges for the researcher. Sometimes policy change as a kind of dependent variable can seem something of a moving target for the researcher. Sometimes it's not clearly defined as a concept, in other words. So in explaining policy change, we have multiple theories to choose from. Those that aim at a kind of holistic approach, such as multiple streams framework, first proposed by John Kingdon in 1984, the Advocacy Coalition framework associated with Paul Sabatier's work and colleagues of Pierce as well. Turning to institutional change, technically rather than policy change, Baumgartner and Jones, punctuated equilibrium model, and of course, historical institutionalist frameworks such as Paul Pearson's path dependency approach. So while these approaches reject simple monocausal explanations, there are many other studies of policy change that highlight the relative importance of specific variables, such as interests, institutions, actors, values, learning, and knowledge, to name but a few. And of course, we should not forget ideas in this list. So where does Marina's framework fit with this body of literature? I would argue that it cuts across these two approaches, in other words, the holistic and the more focused on ideas. On the surface, the book is about the explanatory role of ideas in accounting for the incremental and gradual emergence of an education policy based on the concept of the knowledge economy, or the Europe of knowledge, as Marina mentioned. But don't be fooled. If we dig deeper beyond the title of the book, it's clear that Marina also takes a multifaceted approach. So it's not just looking at ideas, but looking at ideas in the broader context, other factors that matter, recognizing the importance of factors such as policy entrepreneurship, the wider context, or zeitgeist, as is used in the book, member state interests, and so on. While not drawing on one theory, as far as I can tell, and Marina will correct me if that's not the case, it does seem that the book is informed by the wider literature on policy change and draws concepts from that literature, for example, from multiple streams frameworks. So policy entrepreneurship, problem definition, these are concepts that are used extensively in the multiple streams framework. But Marina doesn't buy into the whole sort of model of multiple streams framework. So, but kind of picks and chooses specific concepts that meet her needs. So I think this reflects the fact that her research sits on solid theoretical ground while also being evidence-based or evidence-led. So Marina's empiricism, I mean, she's very theoretical in the work that she does, but her empiricism as well comes through strongly. Her focus on the empirical case is crucial. So to put this differently, the book is not out to prove that ideas matter over and above all other variables, but rather to show how ideas matter within the policy process in a broader context. An example of this is apparent in chapters 3 and 4 of the book, and those are the chapters that deal with problem definition, the emergence of the problem definition, and its development. At this stage, we see the centrality of Commissioner Peter Sutherland, mentioned by Marina, of course, already, who held temporarily the education portfolio in 1985, alongside his competition policy portfolio. Marina shows how Sutherland played the role of ideational policy entrepreneur or problem entrepreneur, maybe, serving as an agent of change and the carrier of ideas within the policy process. While the problem definition emerged as a consequence of material conditions, context, in other words, Sutherland's role demonstrates the importance of how the problem is interpreted and framed, and interpreted and framed in different ways for different constituencies by this key actor in the process. So that's kind of a bit of a summary, but a kind of a summary which is, from my perspective, how I read the book. And as Marina said herself, we'll understand the book in different ways depending on where we're coming from. So I have a few questions that arise, and some of these questions are to ask Marina to expand a little bit on some of the points that she raised in her presentation. So they're not entirely undealt with by Marina in the first place. So first of all, I'd like to push you a little bit on your broader contribution. So personally, I don't work on education policy, although I'm interested in it. So what do you think the key takeaways are from your research for researchers working in other policy areas, not in education? What carryover can we see from this particular case to other policy domains? What might be helpful for someone like me to use? For example, given the importance of ideational policy entrepreneurs in your account, what are you saying more generally about policy entrepreneurship? Are there particular conditions under which ideational policy entrepreneurship becomes necessary in explaining policy change? And that's just an example, basically, to kind of bounce off if Marina wants to do that. So secondly, I'd find it very interesting if you could spell out your contribution to the study of ideas within policymaking at a bit more length, because you talked about the novelty of your approach being one which emphasizes process, but I think that needs a bit more development just to identify what's novel about your particular ideational approach. Ideational approaches to public policy became very fashionable in the 1990s, and Marina refers to this literature in the book, books like those of Craig Parsons, for example, or perhaps Sherry Berman, which were very popular at the time and remain important texts on the role of ideas. So my question is, are you attempting simply to revisit this literature, or are you trying to move beyond it? And if you're trying to move beyond it, in what way or ways are you trying to move beyond it? So that's the second, it's not really one question, but the second kind of set of questions, I suppose. And thirdly, and this is more specifically on the European Commission, might it be argued that your overstating the role of the Commission, and this didn't specifically come through in your presentation, but I felt in the book a little bit. So the role of the Commission in the new education policy, is it overstated? You're clear that the Commission plays only a coordinative role, even now, even at the end of this long process, though you do speak of the institutionalization of the European Commission's role. Why do you find the Commission's role so impressive and a key part of this transformation that you are charting? I think you could probably answer that quite easily, but I'd like to hear how you answer it. And finally, and this is the point at which you can be a bit more speculative, what's next for European education policy? How do you see this policy field developing in the future? The last slide that was shown in the presentation sort of reflected where the book ends, but where do we go from here? Have we reached the limits of the Europeanization of education policy? Are you already thinking about a second edition? Is my question. So to sum up, this fascinating study of European education policy is a well-executed and original piece of research. It's theoretically informed, contributes broadly to our understanding of the role that ideas can play in policy change, and makes a solid empirical contribution to the literature on European education policy. And I'd like to thank Marina very much for putting this book out into the world so that we've all got access to it. So thank you very much.
Nina, do you want to answer these questions right away?
Yeah, maybe I will answer the short clip quickly, and then we can hear the others. So, thank you, Michelle. A lot of questions, and you will get very short answers. No? So let's start from the first one. Okay, the nature of my contribution, right, going beyond European education. these ideas, but is, you know, what type of contribution to these two ideas. I think that the biggest contribution of this book is really to is the theoretical framework, is like this three stage model to capture how ideas intervene in each part, in each step of the policy making. Because, and this relates to your second question, right? I think these questions can be answered together. Your second question was, you know, the literature on the 90s on ideas. I am very grateful to this literature. We are talking about, you know, Peter Hall, no, Sherry Berman, Parsons, Mark Blight. I think that this literature was absolutely important to answer to the question, do ideas matter? Because at the time, ideas were very much dismissed, right, by rationalist scholars, or considered a sort of smokescreen for interest. So there was not so much about ideas as component of political life. And I think this literature was, you know, so important to put ideas to the front of the analysis. Their question was, okay, ideas matter, and the answer was yes. Okay, when there is a shock, when there is a crisis, when there is uncertainty. So I think that in the 90s, the key thing was, okay, when there is a moment of crisis and uncertainty, you have ideas that act as a template for action or roadmap for action. I think that now this sort of, you know, new neo-ideational scholarship, my book, the work that has been done in West European politics on a special issue on the politics of ideas, I think now there is this new ideational turn trying to understand how ideas matter, which it doesn't mean to do a hierarchy, right? Ideas, interest, institution, and see who matters more and when and why. But it means to integrate and incorporate ideational factors in the analysis of other determinants, being them interest or institution. And the second thing, I think most importantly, that me and this new ideational scholarship is doing is also, as I was saying, not to focus so much on what is the effect of the idea, but how did we get there? So what is the process? So, you know, someone would say that this is more a sort of a French approach to public policies, not the cognitive approaches, in the sense of intending the policy process as a battle of contestation between different actors. And this is what I think we should investigate a bit more. I think we should, you know, go back to this, you know, more fine-grained analysis of the role of ideas in policy making and how really ideas empower new interest, new actors, old actors, because we don't know so much about this. And also to focus on more, and this is also a contribution of the book, on this ambiguity of the idea, because in the end, it is precisely when the idea is misunderstood that, you know, the idea wins. Take the Europe of Knowledge or Knowledge Economy in the 70s, had this in 1997, had this monothematic meaning. So Europe of Knowledge was very much attached to a sort of a neoliberal meaning. And when the European Commission, when Edith Cresson wrote the report, commissioned the report towards the Europe of Knowledge, she was attacked by everyone because the meaning of this Europe of Knowledge was very much utilitaristic. Then, when the Europe of Knowledge became a polysemantic, all and nothing, so when it was misunderstood, then when it opened, you know, new political spaces. So I think ambiguity is something that we should analyze much more of ideas, like in my case, Europe of Knowledge, but you have ideas like, again, austerity, sustainability, social investment. They brought a lot about the policy of social investment. So that was, I think, your second question. Also, okay, with process tracing, this is another contribution that I would like to give, because there has been at the moment only one work of Alan Jacobs, who was, you know, how to process trace the role of ideas. And I hope that, you know, this work can also I don't know, be of interest of other scholars that, you know, can apply process tracing level of ideas to other policy areas. It can be education, it can be pensions, it can be health, it can be, you know, any policy area in which there is, as I was saying before, you know, uncertainty, ambiguity, and it's not always clear because we have different goals and different solutions. And then your final question, what next? Well, I think that, you know, we could take exactly the same period, 1973 and 2020, and do another study rather than focusing on the role of the Commission, for instance. Ah, yes, there was this question as well, sorry. But okay, I will answer on what is next. One thing that the book could do is to analyze other actors. For example, there is not so much on trade unions. It would be very interesting to know what European trade unions did in these 40 years on education policy. And it's very hard to do because it's not so easy to go in the archives. You have to book in advance. So the same is for European business. I mean, I gave, I think, a little hint of what the European Roundtable of Industrialists did in education policy. But again, this is something that I think should be much more investigated. The role of private actors, the role of OECD, the role of specific member states in this education agenda, for example, I don't know, in Larsen, you know, from Scandinavia, which I'm sure that, you know, had a lot of ideas in the 70s, in the 1997 on the Europe of Knowledge. And this links to your question, if I am overstating the role of the Commission. Well, I don't know, because one of the motivations to start this book or PhD was personal. From my professional experience, I was a civil servant and I was working for the European Commission, and I was involved in all these working groups that started in the 2000s. So I was one of the person that in Italy was doing the country policy reports that then gets monitored by the European Commission. And I remember when I was writing these reports, you have to answer some questions. So the question was, okay, what are you doing in Italy for enhancing the skills of those who are skilled, rather than what are you doing in Italy for students that drop out? So I started to see that in the templates of the policy reports that we were supposed to write, a lot of questions, again, were emphasizing some aspects of education, whereas were marginalizing other aspects. And, you know, also all these meetings that we had in Brussels, all these working groups, I thought that, you know, there was something that the Commission, you know, had surely much more power than before. It is, I think, that, you know, clear that the Commission has this strong organizational leadership, also ideational leadership, money, because the Commission funds a lot of programs on education, a lot of working groups. Higher education, especially now, the European Commission is giving a lot of money from any possible fund to fund higher education. So overstating, I don't know, sure, the member states are still, you know, very important actors, but what we have seen, it's really an institutional configuration without, again, you know, that's the fascinating thing, without, again, any mandate or legal competence in it.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. I have an additional question also related to the extent to which your causal model travels, or perhaps might have to be extended or supplemented, because you're focusing very much on the EU level. So in education policy, we also see that despite, we could call it a weak institutionalization, there have been tremendous changes at the domestic level as a result of this education policy at the EU level through the open method of coordination. I mean, there's the Bologna process that in Germany has completely turned higher education upside down, though perhaps in other countries a little bit less so. And I was wondering if your account can also, even beyond the institutionalization of the EU, of the policy at the EU level, if your model can also account for the ultimate effects of this policy on the ground? Or would you say there we would need additional explanations for this?
Well, you mean the impact of this agenda?
The Europeanization of domestic.
Well, I don't know, because you know this model is really conceived to understand how a problem emerges and becomes institutionalized. That's it. Because I am primarily interested in the input side of policy formation. I am interested in the policy formulation. So I'm sure, I don't think that, you know, my model is conceived for this. It's really a process sort of model. But I agree with you that, you know, we don't really know so much about the impact of this agenda in member states. Precisely because not being a common policy, there has always been a sort of dismissal. Oh, you know, it's just European, what do you think? But things change, and you know, people listen. We're talking about Germany, you know, it comes to my mind the OECD piece of shock, right? We just needed the one thing that went bad, and then all the countries reacted. So international organizations, I think that they do have this, you know, moral power, soft power of, because as you know, the Xavier Clark Monet was saying, no, we cannot tell you what to do, but we can tell you how you are doing, because they do have this, you know, benchmarking, monitoring, privileged position. But for the model, I don't think so.
All right, thank you. Let's open it up to the audience. So thank you, Michelle and Marina, so far. We now open the floor to questions, both here and online. So for those online listeners, please type short questions into the Q&A box, and we will try to answer as many as possible. And as a reminder, please also include your name and affiliations. And for those here, please raise your hand. I select rounds of questions, and also please let us know your name and affiliation. Okay, we already have one here. So we'll start with you, and then we'll go to an online question.
Okay, so first of all, congratulations for your work. It's a very interesting topic. Well, I had a question. Basically, you mentioned about in 1973, this shift from a social to a more economic concept of education, and taking into account the new functionalist theory of integration, I was thinking, like, is there any evidence of business loving interest that motivated this shift towards an institutionalization of education integration?
You mean it?
To ask for clarification.
Yeah, you mean in 1973?
Yeah.
Lobbying business?
Yeah, because you mentioned this shift towards...
Okay.
All right. Okay, thank you very much. We'll have an online question, and then Mikva, that was a very extent. Yeah, okay. We have Franziska Torres, education policy enthusiast, it says here. Did you find any interesting interactions with other educational systems beyond Europe, for instance, US or the Global South? And Nick, please wait for over here.
Well, first, Nicholas Barr, European Institute, LSE. First of all, congratulations. Fascinating. I realize that a cheap way of criticizing a book is for saying it should have been another book. And I don't mean this in that spirit. I recognize that the book is about policy process. In other words, how and why did policy change, rather than was the policy right? But that said, what struck me was that this focus on growth and productivity, sort of a PISA type view of the world, is really very narrow. And was there ever any discussion of the fact that education isn't just about knowledge and skills, but also about attitudes and values, democracy, gender equality, education not being top down, but a collegial activity, etc. And I mean, in a way, Michelle asked what next, and you mentioned Horizon is picking this up. but do you see any move? I realize, as I say, I'm moving towards, was the policy a good one? Do you see any move towards broadening out the policy objectives beyond the narrow economic growth ones?
Thank you. I think three is already enough. We will have another round. I see. But first, I'll give you the opportunity to answer this.
Okay, so thank you. Very briefly, the first question on the shift. Yes, this is basically the chapter that goes in the mid-70s when education was not there, and then in 1973 you have this general directorate. And let's say that until the beginning of the 80s, education at European level was very much socially oriented. Even SEDEFOP, which is this European Agency for Vocational Training, was founded in 1975. Was founded in 1975 at initiative of trade unions, German trade unions, Maria Weber. So there was a lot of, you know, socially oriented goals for education. Education was, okay, let's learn, you know, foreign languages, let's study the history, the culture. Then, because of these changes in the material context, so the beginning of the 80s, the technological shock, unemployment, and so on, and the need also to modernize Europe, right? It was the beginning of the relaunch of European integration, right? After the crisis of the 70s, the empty chair, Eurosclerosis, and so on, the 80s finally, you know, we smile again, we love Europe. And in that period, in 1983, it was constituted the European Roundtable of Industrialists. It was May 1983. And as soon as the Roundtable was constituted, and this was also, you know, via Etienne Davignon, who was at the time, you know, vice president of the Commission, and they did this Esprit program. So there was a lot going on in terms of trying to make education more fine-tuned with the needs of business, precisely because we were preparing the single market. So, you know, there was need of people able to travel, to speak languages, to work. And I think that, you know, the European Roundtable, but also the Davignon, but also the debate that was coming from the US, right? 1983 was the year of the report and national risk. So that there was something, you know, worldwide going on, you know, we need to focus on education. And so this maybe, you know, explains why the shift was in that period, and especially with Sutherland, right? Then, Francisca question, the interaction with other system. No, I didn't see in the book, but related to the previous question, for instance, one of the closest member of the cabinet of Peter Sutherland, his name was Michel Richonnier, and Michel Richonnier, he was French, and he did, he came to work for Sutherland at the Commission at the beginning of the 80s, but Richonnier did a PhD in San Diego in 1975, so in full Silicon Valley. And I think that, you know, he brought back a bit of these ideas. I think he also wrote a book, now I don't remember the title, precisely on this, you know, Europe needs to be a bit more, you know, modernized. And then, you know, the modernization of France. So it was a period of, you know, things moving a bit from this point of view. So the question of Francisca, the interaction, or no, the only thing I think it would be very interesting to study the link between the US and Europe in the at the beginning of the 80s. And the question of Nick, well, I don't know if I understood correctly the question. Your question is, can we have other objectives? So where are other objectives? And
I think you've actually just answered it by setting the context in which education was about transmitting knowledge, new knowledge, transmitting values as always, but you're saying the growth agenda entered then. So that was the new bit rather than completely replacing the old bit, if I understood you correctly, in which case I understand and thank you.
Yeah, that was the thing. It is true that, you know, I think now we have a bit more, you know, different sort of objectives for education. I think there was a sort of mea culpa as well from the Commission that, you know, for a period insisted too much on this, you know, employability. Because now if you look at the funding, for instance, of Erasmus Plus, a lot of programs are funding citizenship education. Now is, I think, one of the new things of the European Union, precisely because we are in this situation of, you know, populism, skepticism, and inequality. The Commission now is talking a lot about, you know, values, education, citizenship. But it is true that, you know, especially in the 90s, the discourse was very much narrow, very much skills, employability. I mean, there are all these reports of Cresson, especially. She was, you know, the most perhaps neoliberal one of all the commissions, even more than Sutherland. There was a lot about, you know, all these statistics and this, you know, constant obsession of comparison with the US, which everyone was doing perfectly, whereas in Europe everything was so outdated that, you know, we could not produce human resources to fill in the needs of European industries.
Great. So I saw at least three more. Let's start with you, then go over to you, and then there's one in the back. We'll start with
it. Thank you very much. My name is Tamara. I'm an LSE fellow in public policy and administration here at LSE. So I have, I guess, two conceptual questions. You said that about the emergence of ideas and why particular ideas emerge, and you sort of seemingly dismissed the role of powerful agents in why ideas succeed. And I was just wanted to sort of push you a bit more on this, because then you continued with sort of this emphasis on the European Commission as being really important. And I was wondering whether the fact that the Commission was a known actor to member states, whether it, you know, the fact that it had some legitimacy as an epistemic actor, whether that had some influence on the success of its problem definition. And then my second question is around your contribution to the concept of problem entrepreneurs. And so in what way is your book sort of advancing our knowledge and of problem entrepreneurs? And specifically, are there any factors that sort of enable or constrain successful problem entrepreneurship?
Yeah, Bernard Casey, once of this place, once of the OECD and various other places in underway. I wanted to pick up a bit on what Nick Barr said earlier, which is the distinction between a policy formulation, which you talked about, and policy impact. About 20 years ago, under an ESRC initiative, I was looking at something which they called, I think, policy learning in those days. And I was looking at the European employment strategy. And in those days, everybody talked about a thing called the OMC. I felt like a jerk to the past when I heard this term coming up again. Under that, this learning process, but also this monitoring of impact was highly important. And I remember one of the things that developed in that period, which was closely related, which was impact measuring. And there was a thing that was set up that was called an impacts group. And they had indicators, and they had, as the years went on, loads and loads of them. And this list got longer and longer. And there were effectively spreadsheets produced with numerical scores, because they scored just about everything, including quality of work. They managed to score under a number of headings, quite apart from things like employment rates or youth employment rates and this sort of thing. And the whole process disappeared up its own backside after a little while, because actually everything disappeared. I wondered whether, I know you said you were looking at policy formulation, but you were actually looking, and you talked to me about writing reports from one country. So that was kind of entering into something like that. To what extent did that process go on, and to what extent did you see an impact of processes like that, which were in a sense these indicators feeding into development? Because certainly with respect to the employment strategy, those did feed in, and there were changes that were made as they were going along. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Gerasim, and I'm associated with the Bulgarian Entrepreneur and Startup. It's an organization based in Sofia that does policy research and lobbying. Something that I've kind of identified and we kind of bump into quite often is that we come up with policy solutions to certain problems we've identified within Bulgaria, and then we bring it up on our administration or government, and it's quite often just outright dismissed. So something that you brought up is the policy entrepreneur and someone that is able to phrase the problem in a way that then is looked at as like a polysemantic thing, something that each government with the domestic, basically the different member states, can extract value from a certain policy. And well, it's quite frustrating when we come up with some solution and then they just look at it and just scoff at it. For example, we have, well, funnily enough, identified for startup level foreign investment that you can compare it to, let's say, Romania or the Baltic countries, that they've been able to do this and that. And then our government is like, oh, look, they're doing it, so we might pick this policy as well. So my question is, how do you manage to identify what different administrations and different actors care for in a certain problem, or like about a certain problem, so that it becomes polysemantic, so like a certain policy is then in their eyes valuable? It's something that we kind of struggle with quite often.
Thank you.
Okay, so everyone, I hope I will not forget. So the first question was on the emergence of the plural definition. Can you please ask again the first question? The second I have.
So I was just commenting on microphone. Your small point about the fact that ideas emerge or are successful not just because of powerful agents, but because they are polysemic or polysemic. But then you continue to talk about the importance of the commission. And I just wanted to know whether actually that was a crucial factor, that the commission was well known, that it had some authority as an epistemic actor that sort of gave it some sort of, I don't know, power or position in the policy process. So not just the idea itself.
Okay, yes, fine. Actually, in this case, you know, the European Commission was a very important actor in the 90s. 1993, 94, 95, 97. And there you can really identify that there was an actor, the Commission, another actor, the European Roundtable, pushing forward these policies. Then, and this is, you know, the polysemy of ideas and this, you know, debate, fascinating. I'm sure that there is not a straightforward answer there. Relationship between ideas and agency. But then, when the problem definition became institutionalized, so with the Lisbon strategy in 2000, and became institutionalized because of this, you know, polysemantic meaning, so all member states the day before were completely against, then the day after, oh, okay, fine, lifelong learning, equality, and this and that. But it's very difficult, for instance, and this is, you know, let's not focus so much sometimes on the actors. It's very difficult in 2000 to find one actor that was really pushing forward this idea of Europe of knowledge. You had a different set of actors. You had Esping Andersen, then you had Maurizio Ferreira, then you had Maria Joao Rodriguez, the third way, you know, Blair, education. So the idea, I think, was successful partly because, okay, you need always, you know, powerful actors behind, but it was successful because of this, you know, polysemantic meaning. It was even impossible at a certain point to identify, okay, it was this actor who pushed it. So this is when I say, okay, let's also try to understand the role of ideas as autonomous causes, meaning not detached from the context, not separated from material interest, but, you know, something on their own that because of their own attributes, they can also have an effect and enact entrepreneurship and not the opposite, as it is always, which is okay, but in some cases, ideas can also empower entrepreneurs. And this, you know, goes to the question on policy entrepreneurs. I think both of you, you asked me the same, more or less the same question. What I'm trying to do, I'm not trying to invent a new label of the problem entrepreneur. Actually, we are working, you know, with Michelle on a paper on this. What I'm trying to say is, okay, we have the policy entrepreneurs. I think that so far policy entrepreneurship has had a very non-narrow definition. So problem, okay, I'm the entrepreneur and I sell you the solution. What would be, you know, my ambition here theoretically is not to invent a label, but to operationalize, to give some analytical tools on how we can distinguish a problem entrepreneur. And in the case of Sutherland, in a more abstract terms, so let's conceptualize the problem entrepreneur. How I did in the book is, okay, I'm looking for an individual who holds specific ideas, okay, in my case about education, but you can generalize, you know, wherever you are, an individual that holds specific ideas, that possess personal and political resources, team building, social equity, ability, you know, to organize a team, and then is able to exploit a window of opportunity. So these are my conceptualization, not mine, but from theories, right? So a bit from the multiple stream, from Kingdon, no? And then I found, you know, my Peter Sutherland on the basis of this, you know, abstract conceptualization of the problem entrepreneur. So yes, I think that it would be very important, aside, you know, the policy entrepreneurs, to understand that also, you know, the problem stream, to talk in Kingdom terms, no, needs also a bit of agency. So it's not just there the problem, but the indicator needs to be interpreted. So I hope I answered the both of you. And then your question on policy learning, right? That was on monitoring. I do have a part, sort of, you know, reference in the book to the Luxembourg, Cardiff and Cologne process, because, you know, we are talking about, you know, monitoring and benchmarking and everything, you know, started a bit there as well, you know, besides the European Roundtable of Industrialists and their obsession with, you know, benchmarking. So I don't know if your question was if I saw some similarities between the two.
And did it when I was talking about the employment strategy, this thing then was feeding back into the further development. So what one was picking up from there, and although one was picking up more and more, and that's what I found was a rather wasteful exercise. Nevertheless, some of it fed back in so that that thing called the policy developed over time before it then went into a kind of decline and disappeared as well up its own backside. But this feedback process I'm interested in. And that's why I mentioned you sitting as a civil servant back in Italy, filling in reports was part of that.
No, I think it'd be interesting, you know, to study a bit more whether there was a relationship between the DG employment, because
It's not DG employment. Employment happened to mention it, but it did. Sorry, but it's not just DG employment. I mean, was DG, well, if there was such a thing as DG education or something like that, was DG education doing the same kind of thing? That was my question.
Yeah, but because I think they were in the same DG education employment.
Well, sometimes.
I want to fit one final question, or perhaps round of questions, in. We have Tore Bernd Sorensen, a postdoc at the Hertie School in Berlin. Hello to Berlin. Thanks a lot for the event and the exciting book. Do you, in your research, see any patterns over time with regard to EU policy addressing different educational levels or stages, like higher education, compulsory school education, early childhood education and care, et cetera, et cetera? And are there differences in the emphasis of the ideas polysemy advocated with regard to these different levels? So is it just about higher education, or is there?
You mean at European level? Well, I mean, the European Union, I mean, the US tried, I think, to put a little feet in different education levels. It's very difficult that, you know, the EU can do something in primary education or secondary education. And this is why, for example, the EU is doing a lot in lifelong learning, right? Because it's not a domestic policy, so they can do whatever they want. The EU is doing a lot in higher education. We were talking before, you were mentioning the Bologna process, but now there is this very new flagship initiative of the European University Initiative Alliances that are backed up by a budget of the Erasmus Plus, the Recovery Fund, Horizon 2020. So I think they are now investing a lot in higher education because it's easier, you know, to not to be, how to say, judged by member states, because I mean, no one wants really not to touch primary and secondary education. Have always been, you know, super sensitive, especially primary education. But for lifelong learning, for vocational education and training, and for higher education, I think that the European Union is really continuing to do much more. I mean, if you look how many, if you go in the website of the Commission, you see how many working group there are on education. I don't know how many, and how many people for each group. And they continue to look for people to form, you know, more expert groups on education. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I suppose those are also the areas where mobility plays a role, whereas in early childhood, we don't necessarily think mobility.
I mean, we could make also the argument that, you know, the EU is interested to education because it's interested in one of the core four freedom of the single market, right? So you want mobility of people, and the way to do is via education. So, and with Bologna, it was not so successful, but I think that, you know, they're really putting a lot of money and effort in this new initiative. And there is always been recently the higher education strategy and this, you know, new European education area. Is education, like in general, but I think it would be much more, you know, oriented to higher education rather than
right. So, if you allow me the pun, I've never met a European so knowledgeable about Europe of knowledge like you. So, it's been a great pleasure to have the opportunity to for both me and for you, of course, as well, to listen to Marina and Michelle as well. So, thank you to all of those who joined us today here and on the Zoom. Thank you for the stewards and for the events team for organizing this. That's been really great. And special thanks, of course, to our speakers for taking part.